This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Rebuilding a war-torn Iraq amidst a raging insurgency is a tough job. Accounting for the money spent and assessing the results of that effort are the job of my guest, Ginger Cruz. She's the Deputy Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. Her office recently released its 10th quarterly report on the reconstruction effort. It cited progress in some areas, but also detailed a series of failures. A $200 million radio network that doesn't work, a hospital whose cost has doubled, and an oil pipeline that dumps crude onto the ground. Ginger Cruz just returned from a two-month trip to Iraq. Well, Ginger Cruz, welcome to Fresh Air. This is your 10th quarterly report on Iraq reconstruction, and it says in part that most projects visited this quarter showed high-quality workmanship and effective quality control and quality assurance programs. Should we be optimistic about the progress of reconstruction of Iraq?
The progress on reconstruction, Dave, is really a mixed story. While many of our inspections of actual sites, hospitals, railway stations, roads, power plants, showed that in individual cases the quality of construction was good and the quality control was there, there are significant problems found in our audits and in our investigations with cost issues and with scheduling issues. In addition to that, there are many projects which are yet to start or which are experiencing significant delays because of the security situation. So the reconstruction story is definitely mixed. There are successes that are often not that well known by the American public, but by the same token, there's also a lot of failures which our reports do find.
Well, let's look at some of the projects that were problematic. One of them was the Basra Children's Hospital. What happened there?
The Basra Children's Hospital was supposed to be completed in December of 2005, and we initiated an audit at the request of the ambassador because there was significant concern that there was not accurate reporting. When we concluded our review, it turns out that the project is going to be about 150% over budget, and it will probably not be complete until July of 2007. Again, schedule and cost delays that are really hindering progress in the health sector. And so right now there is movement by the Gulf Regional Division of the Army Corps to take over the project from Bechtel, which has failed in its ability to get this hospital up and running.
What's Bechtel's explanation for what happened?
Bechtel says that security was a significant factor. They say they've tried to get the project on track but have failed to do so. But that is something that has been experienced all across the country. There are projects that are being executed in governorates all across Iraq that are experiencing security issues. And in many cases, the Iraq contractors who are subcontracted to the larger companies are getting the work done. So when we did our audit, we considered that it was a failure on the part of Bechtel.
Another project that was troubled was an effort to build a new prison at Nasiriyah. What happened there?
The prison in Nasiriyah started out as a proposal for 4,400 beds, and the contractor on that, Parsons, put in a bid that was way above the amount of money that was available. So there was a negotiation process. At the end of the day, they came to an agreement to build an 800-bed facility, which was significantly diminished from the initial proposal. And they were supposed to complete that by the middle of this year. Instead, again, it's a question of lack of funds and overruns of time. When we went out to inspect the facility, although the quality of construction was good, at the time we were there in early summer, it was only 23% complete. So the Gulf Regional Division, again, the Army Corps, has taken a look at it, decided since the money was exhausted and since the project was not anywhere near completion, they were going to terminate Parsons and instead give the contract directly to the Iraqi subcontractors because there's a greater likelihood that they'll be able to finish the project within the time allotted and within the budget that's left.
You know, it's interesting. I think probably a lot of Americans would assume that Iraqi contractors would be among those most willing to pilfer funds and provide shoddy workmanship, and they would probably believe that Western contractors would be both higher quality and more reliable. It sounds like you're saying that the Iraqi contractors, in some respects, were more reliable.
There is certainly a lot of pressure on Iraqi contractors to do work well because they live and work in that environment. And if an Iraqi contractor is building a facility, they tend to know the people in the village. And if they do shoddy work, the people in the village will know who's responsible for it, and that won't be acceptable. When I was there, I just returned from 2 months in Iraq, went to visit a cardiac facility that was being constructed by an Iraqi contractor. And the cost was remarkably low. It was $500,000 for a facility that had 30 beds in it. It was a critical care unit. And I spoke with the director of the hospital, who said that the engineer who was doing the work was someone who'd been a patient at the hospital. He'd had heart problems, and he'd been treated there. And so there was a community tie of this contractor to the facility, and he did good work. And as we toured it, we found that the quality of the workmanship was very high. On the other side, I also went to visit some hospitals that were being put up by a large design build company. I believe it was a Parsons project. And the quality of work was not as good. And part of the reason was it was subcontracted several times. There was not as much management at the site. The international companies, because of the exorbitant cost of security, were not able to put managers and quality control folks on the ground. And so the general quality of construction that we observed when we were there was not as high.
In a corner of this report, it mentions that over this 3-month period that this report covers, there were 56 new contractor death claims. Right?
Yes.
That's 56 people who died simply trying to rebuild Iraq.
Yes. It's something that I think many people don't often talk about or think about. This is one of the deadliest reconstruction programs ever carried out in recent history. The fact that there's 575 people that were working just in the reconstruction area. We're not talking about civilian deaths. We're not talking about military deaths. We're talking about people that were going out to participate in the rebuilding of a water treatment plant or a power plant or a school, who were killed because of their participation in the reconstruction program. And that's something that I think many people are not necessarily aware of, which is very sad.
Another project that has been problematic is an oil pipeline in northern Iraq that spans a couple of canals. What's happened there?
The Zigatan and Riyadh pipelines have been a problem from the beginning, and that is emblematic of some of the problems that we have with reconstruction, where you've got the Ministry of Oil, which is trying to use its ability to get these projects going, mixed in with large companies that are brought in by the United States, and the fact that the coordination between all of the parties is not as crisp as it could be. And so as a result, it falls through the cracks. When we went to do an inspection of those pipelines, they were not nearly complete. The reports that are brought back to the reconstruction program vary widely. Some say it's 80% complete. Some say it's 10% complete. It was very hard to nail down exactly how far along these pipelines were. And the problem is these are critical pipelines. This is a set of pipelines near Al-Fatah that carries oil across both to the refineries and for export. And there's the potential for billions of dollars worth of revenue that's needed so critically for Iraq's operation and for Iraq's capital development that's not flowing through these pipelines because through a series of mishaps, they have not been completed.
Are they leaking?
They are leaking. These pipelines, many of them are extremely old. The sanctions and the years of Saddam Hussein's rule basically took the infrastructure from the 1980s and left it in a state of complete disrepair. So by the time 2003 rolled around and the reconstruction managers from the United States started to try and build up the oil system, it was very difficult because corrosion has really taken its toll on many of these pipelines. The amount of money needed to get all of the oil systems, all of the pipelines and all of the gas oil separation plants back online is substantial. And I talked with Minister Shahristani, who said that the goal is really to use Iraq money, to use international investment, and to get the oil economy going again. But it's going to be definitely a couple of years before the infrastructure will be able to carry the amount of oil necessary to really get the economy back on its feet.
My guest is Ginger Crew. She is Deputy Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining me, my guest is Ginger Crew. She is Deputy Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. Let's look at some of the challenges that the reconstruction effort has faced. You write that in this report that corruption is endemic and destructive. How widespread is corruption in the Reconstruction effort?
Corruption is, as defined in the Western world, something that really has been a part of life in Iraq for many years. It was the price of doing business. And so as this new democratic regime is taking form in Iraq, the question of how bad corruption is going to be in this new regime is really something that is a new question for the Iraqi people. They, 3 years ago, under Ambassador Bremer, had the creation of the Commission on Public Integrity, the Board of Supreme Audit was recreated, and the Inspector General system was created. And over the last 3 years, those three entities, we call them the pillars of anti-corruption, have really struggled to create for themselves the conditions necessary to be able to fight this war on corruption. But despite all of their best efforts, despite the fact that there's 36,000 cases in front of the inspectors general and there's 1,400 cases in front of the CPI, and they estimate about $5 billion worth of corruption that they're looking at, there's still a lot more to do. There was a study that was done under the military in June that found that about a third of Iraqis pay some kind of a bribe for basic public services, for gasoline, for housing, for security, for electricity. And there's a lot of reason, there's a lot of incentive at the moment to see if these ministries can't attack the corruption and get it down to a manageable level, because if they don't, it could certainly threaten the state.
Have there been any bribe attempts on your own inspectors?
Well, we're not in that position. We did have one undercover agent recently who did a sting operation, and as a result, we did get a guilty plea from a U.S. contractor who was attempting to give a $30,000 bribe in exchange for a contract for vests and some mapping equipment for the Iraqi police. We did a sting operation in conjunction with the Joint Contracting Command. And as a result of the undercover operation of our officers, we were able to make the arrest and subsequently get the guilty plea.
Was a lot of money converted to cash and delivered to people to spend?
Absolutely. At the beginning, it was a cash economy. When you were in Iraq, the only way to move the money around to get it out to the subcontractors and to get it on the ground was to do so in duffel bags. Much of the development fund for Iraq money, the Iraqi money, was done in that manner. And a certain portion of American money was used in that manner, especially when it involved Iraqi subcontractors as well. That makes the record keeping a lot more difficult, and it also makes the ability to go back and account for that money more difficult. And that's something that we are currently tackling, and we're working with the Department of Defense to try and go back and make those records whole to really understand where all the money went.
In May, the new Iraqi government took office, and this raises the question of whether the control of these reconstruction funds are now going to move from American hands to Iraqi hands. What kind of transition issues are you facing?
The Iraqi government has a lot of capacity building issues facing it currently. And I think the thing that reconstruction managers didn't fully appreciate when they came in 2003 was how sheltered and how isolated Iraq had been for 20 years. Much of their infrastructure, much of their master planning, much of their capacity to do work was really stuck in the late 1980s. I visited the mayor's office in Baghdad and talked with some of the water and sewer engineers that were there. And there were these women who'd been working there for 20 years who had hand-drawn the sewer plans for the city, and they knew where the new sewer lines needed to go and where the additions could have helped improve the system incrementally. A lot of times their work was really pushed to the side and fancy solutions were brought in. For example, they brought in AutoCAD, which is a computer system which automates the drawing of a sewer system. And they happily brought that in with printers and all of the latest technology, installed it in the office. And I'm looking at these women who had, most of them, never used the internet, never used computers, and all of a sudden they have to go from hand-drawing these sewer maps to using the latest in technology. The gap there is significant. It's going to take more than a 5-week training program from the people who own the computer system to get them up to speed, and I think that's an example of what's going on all across the country.
We just interviewed Rory Stewart, who was in the British Foreign Service, and he was effectively in charge of a province in southern Iraq in the first year following the invasion. And he told us that when he went back a year later to the region that he had worked so hard to help redevelop, that it was striking how many people said that they had done nothing, accomplished nothing. They seemed to have gotten no credit for the efforts they had made. You've been to Iraq. Do you have any sense of how the reconstruction efforts are regarded by Iraqi citizens?
The feedback that we get is mixed, and the disconnect is really a function of output versus outcome, and let me explain that. In many cases, the American investments have produced products which are not necessarily impacting the lives of the Iraqi people. In other words, if we've built water treatment plants, if the Iraqi government itself is not able to fix the water pipes that actually go to people's houses, the person on the street does not see the value because they're not getting better water. We've built a lot of the generation plants, but if the distribution networks are not there and the power lines are not bringing that power to the people, and they still get up in the morning and only have 4 hours of power all day, they are not going to see the value of what has been put forth by the reconstruction program. It's really an uphill struggle. If the Iraqi government is able to get security in hand, once they are able to control the security situation, the ministries will be able to get the facilities back online, and there will be a boomerang, we're hoping. There'll be all of that capacity that's been built up will finally come to bear, and then the Iraqi people will be able to see it. But until the security is there and until the capacity is there, it's going to be some time before we start to get that feedback from the people.
You know, many journalists have gone to Iraq and reported citizens saying they don't understand how the most powerful nation in the world can't keep the lights on. And if they are angry at the United States for its failures to provide their needs, I guess that only feeds the insurgency, which makes the security situation worse and harder to achieve the fruits of the projects that have been built.
That certainly is the case, and it's something that reconstruction managers think of every day when they're out there and they're trying to come up with solutions that will result in actual progress, visible progress that will be seen and enjoyed by the residents that are there, whose lives we've tried to make better, but who for a variety of reasons are not seeing the results of the programs. Part of the reason, again, is, you know, a lot of times the larger, more ambitious projects that we invested in have not yet borne the fruit because that last mile, that power distribution line, it's that water distribution line, it's that last critical mile that needs to occur before people will begin to see the fruits of the investment. And in a lot of cases, we've talked to Iraqi engineers and people on the streets who make that comparison. They say after the first Gulf War, Saddam Hussein and the ministries were able to jerry-rig everything and get the services back. And that's true because they didn't try to improve everything. They just tried to put it together with chewing gum and rubber bands, and they got it running again. In the case of the U.S. reconstruction effort, rather than taking that approach, the approach was taken, since we've got $21 billion, let's modernize the whole system. Let's bring Iraq into the 21st century.
Sounds like you need $10 million for chewing gum and rubber bands.
In some cases, Iraqis say, why didn't we do that? There's a couple of engineers who say that perhaps the correct strategy would have been to bring Iraq back to where it was prior to the war, literally just take the old systems that they had and switch out the boards and use the old equipment and get it just barely running, and then give them the capability to begin on a road towards improvement. But I think that's part of what America tries to do. And in a lot of cases, again, the potential is there. It's just a question of harnessing that potential, getting the security situation to where these resources and these infrastructure pieces can actually start to produce what they were designed to produce. And once they're able to do that, I've no doubt that there will be a huge improvement in the lives of the Iraqis. But until we can get through this patch, until the security situation is fixed, and until the capacity of the ministries is in place, we won't be able to see that.
Well, Ginger Cruz, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you, Dave.
Ginger Cruz is Deputy Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction.